You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
When I was a novice in biblical studies, Hans Frey's book, The Eclipse of Biblical Narrative, invited me to consider not only the world that gave us the Bible, but also the world that the Bible gives us, to read the canonical texts as world-generating as well as world-contingent. As I continued in the discipline, another world emerged, namely the world that teaches us to pose certain questions and attend to certain realities that interpreters of the text bring to the text. And so I learned to understand the interplay of Torah and creation and wisdom and prophecy in these texts, not only as emerging from their moments of composition, that never goes away, but also from the intellectual and cultural and military struggles of the 19th and 20th centuries, the era of modern biblical criticism. The stories of the Bible's readers stand just as important as the stories of the Bible's writers. Catherine Dell's book, The Lord by Wisdom Founded the Earth, Creation and Covenant in Old Testament Theology from Baylor University Press, renews our inquiries into all these worlds, and Christian Humanist Profiles is glad to welcome her to the show. Dr. Dell, thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Every conversation about wisdom literature in the Bible is going to run into the question, what is wisdom? But we're going to work our way into that kind of in the course that your book works its way into that. So first, I want to revisit some of the 19th and 20th century struggles in the university and beyond that get people thinking that creation and covenant are rivals vying for the core of the Old Testament. Obviously, that's a history that could take a while to narrate, but trace it in broad strokes. Why have covenant people and creation people been at odds in biblical studies?
Well, that's a good question. As you say, it's potentially quite an involved one too. But in broad strokes, we have to go back to the rise of biblical criticism in the 19th century. And there was an interest at that time in historical reconstruction. What were the key events of the salvation history of Israel? What was their nature? In what order did they actually occur? So early source critics sought to dig back beyond the texts themselves to discover all these authors living at different times, maybe even further back into all stages where material would have been transmitted. And the quest was really to find the timeline, not only of events, but of ideas. And so key moments, the Exodus, the giving of the law at Sinai, the entry into the promised land, all ratified by the covenant with Moses, really seem to be at the heart of that salvation history, with both earlier and later covenants, such as that with Abraham on the one hand and David on the other, added to a kind of timeline that evolved of covenant making that could be linked to these key events. The promise of land to Abraham and the covenant that ensued, enduring generations, generation to generation, and then the Sinai covenant with Moses, followed by the covenant with David as the monarchy came into view, and then also the covenant with Noah, regarded in fact as even later in this timeline, largely because it was assumed that creation ideas were added to the salvation history at quite a late stage. So this Noachic covenant, which unites ideas of covenant and creation, was certainly underplayed with the covenant people, as you call them, largely appropriating it and downplaying the creation aspect. Creation people have, in the last 50 years or so, protested against this emphasis and this timeline, and they've started to realize the antiquity and importance of the creation theme, both in its own right and also in relation to the covenant theme itself.
One element of that history that I can't remember where I picked it up, so I assume I probably read it somewhere in Walter Brueggemann, because if I don't remember where I picked something up, I assume I read it in a Brueggemann book somewhere, is that the strong emphasis on covenant really got accelerated in the mid-20th century when, you know, the Protestant emphasis on God as over against the nations really became important. I mean, how important or how peripheral are the events of World War II and the buildup to World War II to the way that Old Testament scholars think about covenant and creation?
Yeah, I think you can trace it a little bit to scholarly development. And yeah, I think that covenant paradigms were very important in the mid-20th century. I think perhaps the environmental and ecological agenda has helped to put creation themes back into our minds. And so I think that people like Brueggemann and his wonderful Old Testament theology have really enabled us to sort of see a more rounded picture. So, yeah, certainly all these sort of things are linked to scholarly ideas and scholarly developments in ideas.
Very good, very good. One move that your book makes that I really appreciated is that you take creation theology away from Genesis 1 through 3 as sort of the exclusive core. So how do readers of the Bible benefit when we start with a broader base than just the opening chapters of Genesis? And what are some of the passages that you recommend as sites for examination when we think about a broader picture of biblical creation theology?
Well, it was partly due to this salvation history timeline that I've just been talking about that Genesis 1 to 3, the creation account that everybody knows, became so prominent. As essentially a primeval history, it really sets the stage for the history of Israel that's Genesis 12, the call of Abraham. But significantly, Genesis 1 to 3 opens the whole Bible. And if you make up your mind that you're going to read the Bible from cover to cover, you will probably read this first, and you may even make it through a number of the early books of the Pentateuch, but possibly somewhere in the legal prescriptions of Numbers and Leviticus, you might lose heart. But it ha certainly has significance as that opening passage. And it is an amazing account, that poem in Genesis 1 describing creation by word, God merely speaking, and the world comes into being in an ordered reality. I mean, this is a very striking and important account. And Genesis 2 to 3, giving us an alternative narrative account of the creation of the earth and all its inhabitants, and of course, the story of the fall from grace. And I don't want to therefore underestimate those passages, but what I'm saying really is that it tends to be them that are focused on, and particularly true in Christian tradition with the fall, which is ultimately redeemed by Christ, to the detriment of other accounts. And clearly, my book is putting its main emphasis on the wisdom literature and on the accounts of creation found there, particularly in Proverbs and Job, especially in Job 38 to 41, where we have a very rich description of God's creative acts in the world. And of course, we can go further and we can find creation themes in the prophets and the Psalms. But what I'm particularly interested in my book, is where creation themes and covenant themes sit together, so that sites for examination might involve passages from Hosea, for example. I quote in my book Hosea 2:18, which famously makes a covenant with the wild animals, the birds of the air, and the creeping things of the ground. And parts of Isaiah, speaking of how breaking covenants directly affects the well-being of the earth, leading to its dryness and pollution, sort of reversing creation, leading to an urging by the prophet to respect the land that mourns and languishes due to neglect. And Jeremiah too speaks of God's covenant with night and day, and other prophets of a covenant of peace to overturn any damage caused by breaking covenants in the past. And even in the Psalms, there's some great Psalms about creation, chapter actually comparing Genesis 1 to 3 with Psalm 104. So there's a really rich tradition out there. That's the point I'm making, beyond Genesis 1 to 3, waiting to be tapped. And if we don't just start there at Genesis, but actually find a different starting point, we start to see it through a different lens.
Very good, very good. What I took to be one of the book's central projects is to move the fusion of creation language and covenant language much earlier in the timeline, so to speak, so that this isn't something that, you have a covenant faction within Israel and then a prophetic faction and then a creation faction and then, much later on, maybe even in the exilic and post-exilic years, they get fused in the written Old Testament. But your project seems to be to move that much earlier and say that some of those established 8th century voices, some of those established 7th century voices are already doing that fusion work. So, in broad strokes, remember, we want our readers to go out and get your book, so don't give everything away. But in broad strokes, I mean, what is your case for that earlier fusion of creation, covenant, and wisdom?
Well, I'm arguing that against a lot of scholarship, which rather saw creation as a sort of addendum to salvation history and ideas that developed in the exile predominantly and after, against those scholars, I'm really saying, well, actually, we can find quite a few nuggets of interest in creation ideas much earlier on. I mean, Genesis 2-3 would be one example, but in the 8th century prophets, in particular in Hosea and Isaiah, and also some of the exilic prophets, you find interest in nature and creation. And then you also find occasional passages where they are linking up ideas of creation and covenant. So I'm saying really that these things are sort of around in a piecemeal way. There's not a direct sort of timeline of these things, but they are obviously aware of different models. Hosea, very famously seeing covenant as a marriage, for example, is a fascinating variant, really, on the usual covenant idea, and seeing it as a relationship between God and Israel, and beyond that to humanity and the created world. So it's really saying it's not quite so cut and dried as people would like to think. And it's something that built up over time. And so by the time we do get to the exile and just after, we are getting a more definite connection between creation and covenant. And the work of Deuteroisaiah, for example, the exilic prophet of the exile, really bringing those two ideas together. But that's what I'm saying. It's a sort of gradual process over time. And it tends to have been a little bit ignored, given the emphasis on other covenants, you know, like the Mosaic covenant, the Davidic covenant. These have tended to dominate our thoughts about covenant. And even the Noachic covenant has been a sort of slightly minor player. So one of the ideas is to bring out the significance of that covenant, which is much broader than the others, and includes the created world, rather than simply focusing on the historical covenants of the Old Testament.
Right. And one helpful thing, and it's something that I should have had in mind, but your book brought it back to my mind, is that, my own tendency is to take the suzerain vassal treaty as sort of the primary covenant, and then, Hosea's idea of the covenant as a marriage as sort of a poetic, metaphoric exploration of that. What your book reminded me of, that again, I should have kept in mind, but I didn't, is that the treaty between kingdoms is itself a metaphor for the however Israel relates to the divine, right? So it's not that one of them is, a, I don't even know what to call it, a literal relationship, and the other one is a metaphorical one, but they are two metaphors, each of which adds something to the way that we can talk about and think about the way that Israel and God relate to one another.
Yeah, I think I mean there are different models of covenant out there. The suzerain vassal idea can be seen in the Old Testament, where you've got sort of overlord versus slave or underling in some way. You can see some of that in Deuteronomy and elsewhere. But I'm really saying one size doesn't fit all, and that there are, yes, different metaphors of covenant. As well as the ones with individual figures, you sometimes get mention of things like the covenant of salt, and in Leviticus, and the covenant of peace with the priestly descendants in Numbers. You know, there's different covenant images out there, and yeah, I think it's helpful to see it in terms of metaphor.
Very good, very good. All right, we're almost ready to take on the question that our listeners are waiting for us to answer. But first, when you write about the personifications of wisdom, you note that the peak of personified wisdom happens historically beyond the bounds of the Protestant Old Testament. And further, you're not entirely sure that when Proverbs 3:19 says that Adonai establishes the world by wisdom, that's a personification, strictly speaking. So take your time here, make your case to our listeners for an alternative way to read those early passages in Proverbs. If they're not personification, what's going on when we see wisdom moving around like some kind of a character in the book of Proverbs?
Yeah, well, this is a good question. I have focused on Proverbs as an alternative to Genesis because here in the concept of woman wisdom, of personified wisdom, we find a startling claim that she was created by God before everything else, and that she then helped him in the creative act and delighted in everything that God made. Then on the other side of the coin, she's inviting human beings to follow the path of wisdom so that humans can enjoy wisdom's gifts and follow a moral code. And for that, they will gain riches, long happiness, etc. So she's a kind of conduit also between God and humanity. And I'm not sure whether she actually reaches a peak at the bounds of the Old Testament. I think her peak is probably in Proverbs 8. But in Proverbs, the concept is not yet aligned with the covenant or the law. And so in the scholarship, it sat slightly uneasily alongside those trajectories. And it was only later on, really, then, that that problem was solved in the literature, largely in the Book of Ben-Sira, the apocryphal book, also known as Ecclesiasticus, where the author aligns ideas of wisdom and Torah. And so that sort of neatly gets around the problem. So rather than wisdom being about universal morality and Torah being about specific laws of Israel, you know, Ben-Sira brings the two together so that acquiring wisdom becomes obedience to the law. So in Sirach 24, wisdom creates the world, but it says she needs a resting place among humankind, and God suggests that wisdom should make her home and receive her inheritance there, it says. And she should rest in the Jerusalem temple where she would flourish and grow. So these connections are made later on, so enable us to kind of bring everything under the wisdom umbrella, sort of fused together. And then you also mentioned Proverbs 3:19. Yeah, because this is another Proverbs text about woman wisdom. And I, in fact, that's where my title comes from. I nicked it from Proverbs 3:19.
That's why I was sure to work it into the question. Yes.
yes, 3:19, the Lord by wisdom founded the earth. I'm using this as a capital W, seeing wisdom, the poetic personification. But there are scholars who argue for it being more generic here. But this verse, in my view, follows straight on from a description of this woman. It talks about her holding long life in one hand and riches and honour in another. She's described as the tree of life in verse 18. And then the Lord by wisdom founded the earth in verse 19. So it seems to me possible to see it as an extension of referring to this figure. But scholars always disagree, and some prefer to see it really more of as an attribute of God alongside his knowledge and understanding, which is also mentioned in this passage. But I see Proverbs 3 as another very important passage in building up this picture of woman wisdom.
Very good. Well, now, I mean, we've got enough texts, I think, in front of us that we can start talking about what wisdom is in these texts. And another thing that I like so much about this book is that it's not a simple sentence long or even paragraph definition, but it is a matrix of sorts in which you lay out, you know, a number of variables, I'm going to call them. You can use whatever term you prefer. Talk a little bit about that. Take a few minutes to tell our listeners, what are the features? What are the movements? What are, you know, the things that make something a wisdom text in ancient literature and in biblical literature in particular?
Are you referring here to the sort of different categories that I raise in the book?
Yes, that's what I had in mind. The foundation, division, provision, life, relationship, and morality.
Yes, that's right. Well, I felt that some kind of framework was needed, really, to show how the creation texts and the wisdom literature could be kind of brought together and categorized, and then use that framework, as a kind of a way of navigating other texts and bringing other texts into the framework, or possibly even saying, well, it doesn't work with some other texts, So I was really trying to highlight that. And so, yes, the foundation of the earth, for example, is something that's very recurrent. The division, that's the division between order and chaos, the setting of boundaries, so that the sea has to be divided from the dry land, the heavens and the earth have to be separated and distinguished. God is all the time, in a sense, controlling the chaos. And it's not a once for all creation event in the wisdom literature. It's actually something that he's constantly doing. He's sustaining the world all the time. So I was trying to draw that out. And then I was also thinking a relationship, God in relationship with humankind, using the figure of wisdom as a means of interacting with human beings and with the wider world, and then morality as well, the order kind of needed in society, which sort of springs naturally from the order that's created in the world, but actually, trickling down in a sense to the way we behave in society and how we manage to interact with each other in a successful way. So these kind of categories were meant to sum up really what this literature is doing in relation to creation texts in particular, and then to be used as a sort of paradigm to take further into other material.
Right. And one of the things I like about this is that, it keeps wisdom and creation from becoming hermetically sealed spheres that sometimes, maybe much later on interact with each other, but rather, and you tell me if I'm interpreting you right or not, because obviously you wrote this book, but it seems like in this book, wisdom is something that, has its sort of primary locus in human society, human person, so on and so forth. And also it permeates non-human creation, just as created order has its primary locus in light and dark, and in sea and land, and in chaos and order. And also, it permeates into the possibilities for human behavior, human relationships, so that creation and wisdom are not, again, two things that some clever scribe had to combine centuries later, but each was already infused, if you will, with the other. Is that a fair reading of your project here, or am I
Yeah,
imposing
I
my
think
own
so.
agenda on it?
No, not at all. I mean, I think that's right, actually, that for the wisdom writers, whoever they were, God as creator is the primary paradigm. They're not engaging with the God of Israel on the whole in history. They are talking about God as creator, and it sets up a sort of picture of a kind of natural law, a universal law, a morality that everybody can follow, and a general sort of formation of character through the kind of morality that is inculcated and ultimately, hopefully, manifested in society. So this sort of angle comes across from the wisdom literature, and it's kind of underpinned, therefore, with God as the creator of the world, because it is for everybody. And this leads then to questions about, well, how was the world formed? And that becomes very prominent in Job, where God answers Job and asks him where he was, to think he knows all the answers, because God does have the answers, and he set it all up, and he created all the minutiae of the non-human world as well as the human world. And in a way, it acts as a bit of a corrective against over anthropologizing the whole thing too. I think that, and that's also something that the Noachic Covenant does, mentioning the animals and the importance of the whole vista of creation, not just human beings. There's a very famous passage in Job, actually, where he actually says, ask the animals and they will teach you. Job says that. As if, you know, don't ignore that the rest of the world might have something to say to us, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely. And another passage in Job that gets a fair bit of attention in this book is what I've always taught as the hymn to wisdom in Job 28, which you seem to present as a definite personification of wisdom. So what kind of person is wisdom in Job 28? And between this text and Proverbs 3, what kind of picture of wisdom is emerging? Or does it make more sense to talk about an array of pictures in the plural of wisdom that emerge in these texts?
Yes, Job 28, you're right, is quite important in my discussion. And I think people tend to focus on Job 38 to 41 as the main creation text in Job, but I've been really trying to sneak 28 in. I feel it's sometimes missed, really, as another important contributor to the creation theme, but also that it does align with the figure of wisdom. And you know, she's not explicitly personified here in the way that she is in Proverbs, but it's a kind of mention of her. So in a sense, she's not really a person, but she's an entity, certainly a separate entity closely related to Proverbs' portrayal. The passage doesn't explicitly mention the creation of the world either, but its description reflects the wonders hidden in the earth that human beings can discover. And it's a wonderful poem. It opens with a description of humans mining for silver and gold, iron and copper, deep in the earth. And human ingenuity allows the miners to dig up all kinds of precious jewels and bright stones, all brought to light through this ingenuity. And immediately, the mention of the precious stones reminds us of woman wisdom in Proverbs, who offers precious gifts to those who follow her path. And she stresses that her fruits are better even than, you know, valuable diamonds and jewels. God doesn't seem to be in the picture in Job 28 until the second half of the poem, when it becomes clear that there's a kind of double entendre, because it says that the miners dig deep, also implying that God can dig deep, that God seeks out the farthest bounds, and even getting on to overturning mountains. And I mean, it's really God who can do. Wisdom here is described as hidden largely from humankind, not as fully attainable by humans or animals. But and there's some nice description also of the falcon. The falcon's eye cannot see it. You know, the falcon's eye sees everything, but it can't find wisdom. Some lovely imagery here. But saying really, wisdom is only fully known to God and in relationship with God. You know, this is sort of bolstering the picture that we already get from the other texts. And in Proverbs 3 again, we could perhaps here also be catching a glimpse of the same female figure. I like your word array, because I think we are getting different pictures here of wisdom. And sometimes they're in the first person, sometimes they're in the third person, and they vary across these texts. In Proverbs 1, 20 following, there's another picture of wisdom, and there she seems to almost take on a slightly prophetic hue. You know, so I think, yeah, the array is a good word, because I think it's getting across the richness of the concept, really.
Well, I want to follow up on that, because one thing that occurred to me as I was reading your book is that in Job 28, wisdom is so hidden that even the eye of a falcon could not see it. But in the early chapters of Proverbs, both, you know, woman folly and woman wisdom are calling out from the doorway and saying, here I am, you know. So, I mean, you know, do you think it is more fruitful to see that as, you know, two facets of an ongoing elaboration on wisdom? Or is that a dispute on the relationship of wisdom to the human? Because I could make a case for either, but I'd like to hear how you would relate those.
Yeah, I'm quite interested in this difference between these two books because, yes, as Proverbs, it's very much open to all. There's no sense of nobody being able to access wisdom. You know, even the fool can become wise if he changes his mind and his heart. So it is interesting that you seem to have there some sort of development in Job where wisdom is somehow hidden and becomes a kind of almost like a bit more of a principle of the world, because it says that the heavens have only heard a rumor, Abaddon, the place of the death has only touched on it. That it's almost as if it's not really even fully understood by the cosmos. It's absolutely God who knows all, and even outside that, it's not fully comprehensible. So there does seem to be a slightly different view here coming from this author, and perhaps it's part of his expressing the sort of wonder and awe of the other in a slightly more profound way, whereas in Proverbs maybe it's a little bit more everyday and more attainable. But
Very
yeah, this is a conundrum. It is a
okay.
conundrum.
Well, good, good.
I haven't got all the answers in my book,
I'm glad I
but only
wasn't the
some
only
of
one confused. I that's comforting. That's comforting. I do want to stick with Job for a bit because one of the things that for the longest time I resisted, but your book makes a pretty strong case for it, is to take the behemoth and the Leviathan in Job as a hippopotamus and a crocodile. And I've always thought it made more sense to take these as sort of Enuma Elish's chaos monsters, some relation of Tiamat or something like that. But you make the case for the zoo animals. So again, I want our readers to read your book, so be sure not to give all of it away. But in broad strokes, why should we take Behemoth and Leviathan as zoo animals?
Yeah, well, I think there might be some difficulty with placing them in a zoo because they would be a little unconstrained. But yeah, I mean, there are many other scholars who've written on these creatures, and I only really touch the surface in my book. But I have tried to take the description of them in the context of what's just come before in the description, which is a list of various, mainly wild animals that God describes as created by him, and God delights in the ways of these animals, but they're largely unknown to humans, and they are in the main untamable by humans, and God is almost rejoicing in their idiosyncratic behavior without the weight of human moral parameters set around them. So if you think of it this way, that this is a list of all these animals, then the behemoth, which comes first in that light, could be seen as another in the list of those creatures. And I think features of a hippopotamus appear in the description. I mean, he lies under the lotus plants in the covert of the reeds and in the marsh, it tells us. And it also says that even if the river is turbulent, it's not frightened. The idea of treading its ground in a violent river. And Leviathan, then, the description of Leviathan follows in chapter 41, and this sounds like a crocodile to me. The author praises its limbs, its mighty strength, its splendid frame, its impenetrable double coat of mail, and its terrorizing teeth. And admittedly, it takes on some elements worldly. It talks about smoke coming out of its nostrils and fire coming out of its mouth. So that sounds a bit like a dragon, perhaps. But I think there's a bit of poetic license in there as well, actually. An exaggeration is a well-known factor in all these sorts of poetic descriptions. So I think scholarship's been a little bit too influenced by other models of cosmic overturning of large monsters at creation, which of course we get in the Enuma Elish, the famous Babylonian account of the creation, which is often compared to this material. But I think we've been rather over influenced by that rather than taking these texts on their own terms. And of course, Enuma Elish has the monster being cut open, hasn't and developing the heavens and the earth from the two halves of the body. So you can see how this idea of overcoming a chaos monster seemed to fit quite well with these images. But interestingly, of Leviathan here in Job, it's said that on earth it has no equal. And for me, that suggests it's firmly grounded down below here on earth. It's not really such a cosmic entity. So that's really how I've developed this idea of it not so much being about kind of chaos camp, but really being about major creatures on this earth.
Okay, that makes good sense as an account. I'll have to pull back a little bit on the Godzilla version of Job going forward. When I first started taking academic biblical studies classes in the mid-90s, I came away with the impression that Genesis 1's image of a divine emperor was kind of peculiar to Israel, that combat myths like the Enuma Elish that we just talked about were far more pervasive creation stories in the kingdoms that surrounded Israel. So again, leave our listeners with, some good reasons to get your book and read your book. But in broad terms, what is your case that creation by speech is a more common trope among ancient texts of this region?
Yes, thank you for that question. I'm not sure I would describe God as a divine emperor in Genesis 1, but interesting image.
I guess because, and this is probably just Semitic grammar, but he says, let us create. That
Yes,
seems like
that's
something a
true.
Persian emperor would say.
Yeah, the royal we. It sounds like the
Yes,
royal
yes.
we, doesn't it? Yeah. Yes, but what I'm really saying here is that really, as an alternative to a kind of combat myth idea, the idea of battle and opposition, rather than that, what we actually get in the Genesis creation account is creation by word. God speaks creation into being, and there it was. And I find that fascinating, thinking about the wisdom literature and the emphasis, which is very strong there, on speech and communication. A lot of proverbs about when to speak, how to speak, how important careful words are, a real interest in that theme. And so, this aligns for me with God speaking words to call creation into being and then making his creation. And so it makes the world sort of relational to the creator through this process. God is described as planting, causing things to happen, forming things, blessing things. And then he's walking in the garden with his human beings, and so he's kind of forging relationships at all these levels. And in the same way, I think wisdom forges relationships. She forges them with God, and she's also forging them with humankind, bridging that creator, creature gap. Actually, in my book, draw a brief parallel in a footnote, actually, with Tolkien's Silmarillion, because there it's actually creation by music, and he talks about a first note uttered by the divinity, which builds up into a full symphony in the end. And notes of discord can be found, but ultimately notes of harmony joined together in praise of the created world. And I just find that a beautiful alternative picture of creation. So, it shows that the idea of creation by word's not the only model at all. There are other models out there, but I think it's fascinating when you're looking through a wisdom lens that that emphasis is there and links up so nicely with wisdom literature and the emphasis there. So.
Right. And this is something that I didn't send along in the notes before we started recording. So if this would take further research, just say so, and I'll apologize for going astray. But one thing that I'm curious about, the Egyptian wisdom texts we have and the other wisdom texts from outside of Israel, do they go in creation directions the way that Israel's wisdom texts do, or do they tend to be more social and ethical texts? Is there a cosmic dimension to international wisdom?
Oh yes, there's definitely a cosmic dimension, but the most significant thing is Israelite monotheism, because the wisdom literature here just assumes that there's one God. There's just no discussion of any other gods, whereas nearly all the paradigms from the ancient Near East involve an array of gods. The Enuma Elish is a battle basically between different gods. And same in Egyptian thought. I mean, it's gods and goddesses there. And some people have said, oh, maybe woman wisdom is the vestige of an Egyptian goddess. There was this principle of order called Maat in Egyptian thought that later in their thinking became a goddess of order. And this quite neatly sort of fits in with woman wisdom. And, you know, who really knows exactly what the influences were upon these developments, and some Egyptian influence is quite possible. So I think, I think that this is these ancient Near Eastern paradigms very important for our understanding of this material, but that there are significant differences. Clearly, the Israelite authors, the sages, they were welding these traditions together into their own synthesis and making something distinctive. Sorry, does that answer your question?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And you know, one of the places where that synthesis happens, and where, you know, this relationship between wisdom and creation becomes, I think, very clear to see, is the episode, the paradigmatic episode where God doesn't actively destroy things, but rather God simply relents in holding back the forces of chaos and allows order to be destroyed passively, to punish Israel or to punish other entities when they rebel. So, I mean, talk a little bit about how the Noah story and the Noachic covenant bring these ideas we've been talking about of creation and wisdom together in that narrative framework.
Yes, I mean, the flood is a good example, really, of where creation does really run wild again. It's a kind of overturning of creation, an undoing of everything that we'd read about in Genesis 1, undoing that all-important order and allowing the chaos to return. And in the primeval history, it's not just Israel who's being punished here, but all humankind and even all the animals. Perhaps the fish survived this great torrent, but even then, I think, you know, whirling waters might not have been the best environment for them either. But Noah is the one, of course, who is chosen as the human representative to restore God's order, to bring the ark onto the dry land and to keep the line of the animals alive and multiply the human race all over again. So the chaos gets kind of reversed again back into the order. And there's this same sense of that the water's got to be contained, and that's done by the shutting of the fountains of the deep, and the opening, the windows of heaven are also they were open and now they're closed. The waters take time to recede, of course, and the mountains are gradually revealed, with Mount Ararat where the ark rests. And then we have Genesis 9. And so Genesis 9 is the kind of moment of recognition of this sort of second creation. And this time it's said, you know, this is not going to happen again. The promise is made by God that this is a new covenant, which means that he will never do that again. So this becomes quite a big covenant. It's not just with Noah and his family. It turns out to be a covenant with absolutely everything, with the birds, the insects, the animals, the whole creation. And of course, the sign of that covenant is the bow, the rainbow in the sky, which is a sign to ratify the covenant that's made. So I think here, this is why Genesis 9 for me is the real highlight of the way that creation and covenant come together in that wonderful image of the rainbow. And this is where really at the heart of my book, which is why there is a rainbow on the front cover.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Now here's another question of canon development. And again, I didn't write this in the notes. So if your answer is, I need to think about that further, feel free to say that. But you know, one thing that occurs to me as you talk about that is that, you know, certain passages in Isaiah, especially, which is a book that I teach with some frequency, but also in Hosea, Amos, you know, has these threats, right? And I'm going to call them threats. If you prefer another term, feel free to fill that in, where, you know, God says through the prophet to the people, you know, if you continue to violate the covenant, or if you do not return to the covenant, or, you know, there's variations on it, I'm going to let the nations run wild on you. Right. And what occurs to me is, I mean, you know, is this something where those prophetic warnings that sort of personify military historical developments later on become a more literal narrative of divine release in the Noah story? Or does the Noah story become a metaphor for thinking about military history? Or do they develop independently and then, you know, they show up next door to each other in the Old Testament and say, hey, funny thing, I just met the neighbor and he also... which story among those, or does another story entirely make the most sense to you?
Well, there's always this question of which came first, isn't there? And traditionally, the Noachic covenant has been seen as a later covenant because, you know, this sort of paradigm which thought that ultimately creation ideas really entered Israelite consciousness at the exile when they were in Babylon, where a lot of these texts were. So that perhaps there was a new sort of synthesis at that time and they were bringing creation more profoundly into their own nationalistic salvation history. So, I mean, that's quite a common paradigm. So that puts that would then put the Noachic covenant late. I'm sort of saying, well, it's not necessarily that late. I mean, I'm a little bit, I don't want to get too tied up with questions of dating. In terms of, the prophetic passages that you're talking about, yes, I mean, obviously, breaking the covenant has all sorts of ramifications. And I think one of the interesting things that I try to point out is the effect on the earth itself, on the land. You know, it talks about the land drying up and withering because of the breaking of the covenant. And we all know that in warfare, you know, land gets besieged and ruined just as much as there's also all these casualties, humans, animals and so on. So, I mean, you know, it does actually link up with the creation itself, that the creation itself is damaged by this, by war or by breaking covenantals of agreements, and so, you know, that these images are sort of all around the Old Testament, I think. So I'm struggling to sort of quite link the two, because I think they link in the idea of the well-being of the land. And after the flood, of course, you know, the land is revealed again and it's able to prosper. But I think all the way through the Old Testament, there's this feeling, well, it can also be damaged again. And that it's a constant sort of cycle.
So I mean, would you be more inclined to say that these are just different sprouts from the same soil?
Yeah, I think they are. I think there's a big thought world out there that is sort of manifesting itself in different ways. And we have different groups of thinkers and writers in ancient Israel who are, you know, putting things in different language and different ideas. And
very good.
There's a big melting pot out there, in
Excellent.
My view.
Excellent. So, I mean, you know, to start thinking about the big picture of the book, I mean, your book invites readers to consider creation not as a single narrative, but as an ongoing development of a theological theme that retells itself in several narratives as it develops. So what kinds of things do we see more clearly when we don't try to take the creation stories as pieces of a jigsaw puzzle and create a single timeline? If we allow them to be plural, what kinds of things can we see better?
Yes, I mean, I think this takes me back to these scholarly paradigms of creation as late, for example. You know, and also that it was all from the ancient Near East. This was another paradigm that, oh, the creation was not so important in Israel because it was kind of shared with other nations. And it was really the covenant and the distinctive Israelite story that was central, you know. So these sorts of paradigms have needed to be overturned in a sense. I think that the ancient Near Eastern myths are ancient and contact may well have happened much earlier on, as I said. Creation also appearing in the prophets as sort of nuggets of these ideas and sometimes also linked up with wisdom ideas. So I'm against the idea of a timeline, really, of a it's a complex process of amalgamation. It makes one think perhaps of the timeline of creation in 7 days, as in Genesis 1, because that makes it sound as if it's all in a timeline and it's all really neatly ordered. And so I think when we depart from that model and we look at creation in other texts, particularly from the wisdom literature, we see that it's not really quite so ordered, and it doesn't seem to happen within a timeline. Rather, the process is more piecemeal and it builds up, and it and as I said, the creator is sustaining life as well as creating it, so it's somehow more complex than being a once for all event. So I think on that level too, creation is not quite so straightforward as we might think if we just read Genesis.
Very good, very good. Well, you mentioned the prophets there, and I want to turn towards the prophets here as we start to approach the end of our interview. Your chapter on the prophets challenges a picture that puts the Mosaic covenant at the core of the Bible's claims about God and Israel, instead suggesting that Davidic notions of covenant or even fertility cult notions of divine relationship might be present as early as those Mosaic ideas. So this looks like good evidence that fusions of covenant and creation are happening very early indeed. So talk to us about the possibility some more. What might change about the ways that we understand the prophets in particular and the way that they relate to that covenant-carrying prophet Moses?
Yes, well, I think as I've sort of already indicated, I think it's very important to show that there are different covenants in the Old Testament, different models. And although the Mosaic covenant is obviously a very key moment in the God-Israel relationship with the giving of the law, this should not become our only model. And so I do think that the Davidic covenant is also important because this is the moment when structures change in ancient Israel and the period of the kings comes on the scene. And I tried to show in my book how the prophets like to use these different covenant models. They like to play with them a bit. Jeremiah 33, 20 to 22, for example, he's playing with ideas of a covenant with the day and the night, which makes us think about Genesis, to ensure that the known cycles continue. And he compares and intertwines with the Davidic covenant. So God is saying here that the Davidic covenant could only be broken if the cycles of day and night could be broken. And we know that the day and night cycle is not going to be broken. So it's a way of saying, in a very roundabout way, that these things are not going to happen, that the Davidic covenant stands, it's going to stand forever. And it's impossible for God to break that, just as it's impossible for him to break the cycles of day and night. You can see the prophet there sort of weaving together the Davidic covenant with a more sort of nature orientated or cycles of life type of covenant idea from the creation tradition. So I think the prophets are quite creatively mixing and matching some of these allusions I said about Hosea and the way that you think he's talking about the Mosaic covenant tradition, but then he's also talking about the marriage relationship, and he also talks about the marriage of heaven and earth, restoring some sort of cosmic harmony and fertility to the world. So, he's branching out from a simple sort of one-dimensional idea to kind of bring in other ideas. So I think we're finding nuggets of evidence that these earlier pre-exilic and exilic prophets were playing with different models of covenant, and they weren't restricted, therefore, to the imagery of the Mosaic covenant, even though that's a central paradigm and it was used. They enjoyed playing with different things, and they included creation and covenant together at times, as we also find in Genesis 9. So I think Moses is not the only covenant carrier. Abraham, David, Noah, and others are covenant representatives. And then, as I said before, beyond individuals, you also get other covenants with animals, nature, salt, priests, whatever else we want to talk about. So, the concept of covenant relationship is really much broader than Moses alone.
Yeah, and you know, like I said, I mean, I think this is the best work that this book is doing on me is that I'd say it was subconsciously. I don't think that I intentionally go about it this way, but sometimes I think about, you know, sort of that suzerain vassal formula in Exodus 20 as being the beginning of covenant thought. And that, you know,
Yes.
anytime Hosea brings in fertility or marriage, and anytime that you know, we get the language about the chosen king in, you know, Psalm 2 or in whatever chapter of 2 Samuel it is, 6 or 7, that those are kind of poetic riffs on something that was original, something that was solid, something that everyone would have known. That's what covenant is. And what you're suggesting, I think, and you can correct this if I'm getting it wrong, is that there is no single core to covenant, but rather it's a number of streams flowing together, and that at any given
Exactly.
moment, it pays to pay more attention to the particulars of this covenant passage rather than taking, you know, Exodus 20 as the covenant core and then seeing how does this passage change it. Think of Hosea as a potential origin point rather than as a later variation. Is that a good reading of your work here?
I think so, yes. Yeah, I
Okay,
think
very
so.
good.
Just to say there are lots of different starting points. And
Very
in a way,
good.
I'm, you know, in a way, I'm playing with different starting points. I mean, I'm not saying historically there was first the sages and the wisdom literature and then everything else, because I don't have any proof for that. But what I'm saying is this is an interesting lens. So if we just sort of take that out and use it as our channel into more sort of familiar material, we might just see it from a different angle. So I'm trying to say this is not necessarily, you know, the way it was. It's just a way of broadening out our sense of the sort of rich diversity, I think, there of the Old Testament that we sometimes lose when we over-focus on certain models.
Very good. Well, I want to focus on one more biblical figure as we head towards the ending here. And your investigations recommend to readers a picture of the biblical text in which covenant is more often intrinsic to wisdom than it is alien to wisdom. So talk about that big picture that emerges from that understanding, starting with Solomon. So how does Solomon, the son of David, fit into this view of covenant, creation, and wisdom as streams that flow together rather than variations from a single origin?
Yes, Solomon. Well, I've actually written another book about him. So that's a book for another day. But for me, he's a figurehead who unites wisdom and covenant in particular. We're told, of course, in 1 Kings 3 that he's given wisdom by God. He has a particular relationship with God, enjoyed by no one else. Because he's endowed with wisdom more than anybody else. But he's also a king in the Davidic line. So there's language around the Davidic covenant to do with him. He inherits the promises made through that covenant, and he represents the people in covenantal relationship with God, as all the other kings did and will do in that line. And later in life, indeed, we're told that he broke the covenant, that he went astray. But the question is whether we should interpret Solomon's significance solely with the Davidic covenant in mind, or whether he, in some ways, embodies a kind of new wisdom covenant relationship. Because I think the wisdom gift to Solomon is really bound up with covenant blessing. He's given a wise and discerning mind, and he's given riches and honor, all the usual gifts that wisdom brings. But then this is linked directly to the covenant with David as well. So it's as if this author is wrapping them up together, rather like the prophets wrapped up other covenantal images too. So I see Solomon as wisdom's foremost exemplar and as its covenantal figurehead, in the same way as Moses, Abraham, David, Noah represent and embody other covenants within the Old Testament. So if you buy my argument here, then I think we can see covenant as more intrinsic to wisdom. And if we also link that up with the creation worldview coming from wisdom, which I've also described in the book, it also neatly aligns with this kind of wisdom creation covenant nexus that I am trying to describe in this work.
Very good. Well, Catherine, I have been at the wheel for most of this conversation, so in the spirit of hospitality, I'm going to let you have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about creation, wisdom, Old Testament theology, or whatever else as we head for the door?
Well, I think I really want to say to listeners that this book is much more than just an academic debate. Of course, my book is grounded in what scholars have said before and in the ways that texts have been interpreted over the years. But I've tried to make a fresh synthesis of ideas and material, and I think that it has quite an exciting relevance to the way that we think about the world and our place in it now. And looking back on my own interest in this whole subject area, one of the reasons I was attracted to the wisdom literature was that it did have this kind of universal appeal, an appeal to human experience generally that is lacking in much of the rest of the Old Testament. So its focus does come away from just Israel and the goodies and baddies and all the characters of Israel and outside the history of Israel. So it's much broader. So in the course of my studies, I've concluded that perhaps wisdom shouldn't be isolated, because the danger of saying it's different is to isolate it. And so I'm saying it shouldn't be isolated from the rest of the Old Testament. In fact, quite a lot of this work is to try to integrate it with the other more Israelite thought worlds. But what I am saying is that it is a distinctive strand of thought, and it also can impact the way we read other strands of thought within the Old Testament, the way we see other beliefs and doctrines in these texts. So wisdom is no longer an addendum to other texts and ideas. It becomes more center stage. So this is why I start with those texts and their creation ideas. And then I move slowly into other texts that seem to resonate with these ideas. And then I go on to mainstream covenant texts, particularly the covenant with Noah, that also seem to link and integrate to these ideas. And so I'm moving, you know, carefully through to sort of bring it all together into a picture of Old Testament theology, which is a little bit unlike some of the ones that have come before. So I'm hoping that this will stimulate fresh interest in the subject area and, as I say, be of a slightly broader appeal than simply a small group of scholars engaged in a rather erudite academic debate.
Catherine Dell, thank you for joining us on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The book is The Lord by Wisdom Founded the Earth from Baylor University Press. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Britt Stack is our audio editor, and I'm Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.